From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, strange and bizarre story night. Here's what's happening. President Trump has delayed the release of thousands of pages of classified documents related to the John F. Kennedy assassination, bowing to pressure from the CIA, the FBI, and other federal agencies still seeking to keep some of these final secrets about the nearly 54-year-old investigation. Now, the president did allow the immediate release of 2,800 records by the National Archives following a last-minute scramble to meet a 25-year legal deadline. Following lobbying by the national security officials, though, the remaining documents will be reviewed during a 100-day period. We'll see what happens. The records were put online, thousands of field reports, cables, interview summaries from dozens of FBI, CIA, and congressional investigators, revealing the minutiae of a chase for information that spanned decades and covered continents all over the planet. Usually typed, stamped secret, and often annotated by hand, the files are a paper trail of detective grunt work, leads exhausted, dead ends encountered, sources checked and rechecked. And many of the files reveal the desperate search for Oswald's possible connections to communists, Cubans, or both. And I think they've missed the boat. Dr. Jerome Corsi from Infowars.com and author of Who Really Killed Kennedy with us. Jerry, I got to tell you, I'm a little disappointed so far in the media because they all seem to be focusing on Oswald.
Well, that's right, George. First of all, I think we'll get more documents, but the point I want to make is that the intelligence agency is fighting so hard even today, you know, more than 50 years after the assassination, to resist these documents from fully being released. I think it indicates, again, culpability of the agencies, at a minimum, in having done a suppression, that they were not going to cooperate with the Warren Commission, they were not going to release information, they were going to concoct an official story that Lee Harvey Oswald did the assassination as a sole assassin, all of which was a government cover story, the official version. And that's very clear that even today, the CIA is trying to protect that official version by not releasing all the documents. I mean, if the documents had in it a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald shooting the rifle at John Kennedy out of the, you know, sixth-floor window of the Texas School Book Depository, why wouldn't it have been released?
Right, exactly, because it doesn't show that at all, Jerry. Now, do you think the president caved, or should we have released everything today?
I think the president was under enormous pressure, and certainly from what, you know, Roger Stone has said so far publicly, Pompeo, the head of the CIA, put enormous pressure on President Trump to say we need more time. Now, if you read what President Trump said today in his memorandum, he said he's going to postpone for today the release of the remaining documents, and he's going to look at the concerns of the agencies over the next 180 days. He said at the end of that period, I will order the public disclosure of any information the agency cannot demonstrate meets the statutory standard for continued postponement of disclosure. In other words, he said, you better have a pretty important reason that this document not be shown in its complete form, or I'm going to release everything.
There seems to be some interesting stuff that came out about the Soviet Union at the time, Jerry, where they believed it was definitely a conspiracy. They were concerned that it might have been a coup within this country, always that possibility, and that generals and other hardliners were going to try to take over the country, and that would have been, of course, a disaster for the Soviet Union.
Well, and there's very clear evidence of these documents released tonight that the Soviet Union in 1963 believed that Lyndon Johnson was behind the conspiracy, and they were making a major effort to find out who Lyndon Johnson was, and you know, what his gain, what clearly gaining the presidency, what it meant to the Soviet Union. But the suspicion of Russia immediately was upon Lyndon Johnson. And also, these documents confirm a lot of the research that's been done of how extensively even President Kennedy was involved in this Operation Mongoose, which ended up being an assassination attempt against Castro.
Well, and there were many attempts and plans to try to do him in. Jerry, thank you. You're going to take some time combing through all these documents. We are going to get you back when we do our JFK special as one of our special guests around November 22nd, of course, the anniversary of the assassination. But so far, documents have been released, but some real important ones are being held back for now. And the sad part about all of this, Jim Marrs is no longer with us. He would have loved this moment to begin to comb through some of these documents. Thanks, Jerry. North Korea, Kim Jong-un is a little concerned, scrambling to avoid uprising. Listen to this story. North Korea could be on the brink of civil war as furious locals targeting memorials and monuments glorifying the bloody Kim dynasty as their anger grows over poor living conditions. Strange story there. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. I'm still waiting for this thing to really pop, John. What do you think?
Well, I told you, you know, a couple days ago, I think it's in a holding pattern right now. I think these reports about desecration of some of the great monuments to Kim and his family, and the recognition of these massive re-education, brainwashing facilities, these torture chambers with apparently about 120,000 prisoners in it, is, you know, just more proof that, you know, this regime's, the days of this regime may be numbered at some point. I mean, it's going to take a long time before, you know, they would need great help externally from a force like the United States to really bring about any regime change. But I think the really mind-blowing story today that came out, George, if I can pivot a bit, is with Rex Tillerson, who I think it may be on his way out right now. I mean,
there's talk about that.
He is absolutely off the wall when it comes to Syria. He's like saying, well, we want to reinstate the High Negotiation Commission. That's the Saudi group led by, you know, their foreign secretary, U.S. educated Abdel Jubar, and these people funded for 7 years the insurgency in Syria that began. Yes, it began with the Arab Spring of the Saudi Arabians funding insurgencies in numerous Middle Eastern countries. The Saudi insurgency in Syria has totally failed. Al-Assad, the dictator, is firmly entrenched in power and has nearly 100% control of the country now.
Yeah, stronger now than he was a year ago.
100% stronger. And yet Tillerson is saying today that Al-Assad's days are numbered because he's going to get together with Stefan de Mistura of the UN, and they're going to stomp their feet with the Saudis and demand that Al-Assad go. And so it shows me that Tillerson is really perpetuating the Obama policy, but is completely out of sync with Trump's position on Syria.
And Jerry, very quickly, your reaction to some of the JFK files being released today.
Oh, thanks. I think, you know, that the major cover-up that exists is with the incredible incompetence of the FBI and CIA. And I know that, you know, this doesn't meet exactly the standards of some of these major conspiracy theories, but think about the embarrassment of knowing Oswald defected in 59 or whatever and returned. He was a known Marine marksman, sharpshooter. A lot of these files now are confirming what people have known for a long time, which is that he traveled at least like maybe 7 weeks, 5 weeks, whatever it was, to Mexico City, met with the Cuban spies and ambassadors from Russia and from Cuba in Mexico, came back, and then assassinated President Kennedy. Well, apparently there was one document from an FBI official that had a note indicating that Oswald had stated to the Cuban officials in Mexico City that he was going to murder President Kennedy. And that document was taken by this official and torn up and flushed down the toilet.
Yeah, it was crazy. All right, John, thank you so much. Really appreciate all your work. I'm not sure, though, I've got to tell you, I'm not sure that the person who went to Mexico City was the Lee Harvey Oswald. I think it might have been somebody posing as Lee Harvey Oswald. And, you know, of course, Oswald always said he was the patsy. And there's probability that there was. And, you know, there was a commission that reinvestigated the assassination, and they concluded that JFK was most likely killed by a conspiracy and several gunmen. So it's a story that we're going to dive into deeply as we get close to the assassination anniversary date. A man in Southern California has been arrested after allowing his 11-year-old nephew to drive his car while he was drunk and passed out in the passenger seat. Now, on one hand, it's good that he didn't drive, but to let the 11-year-old do it? No, not at all. Calling it a national shame and human tragedy, President Trump has declared the opioid epidemic crippling American communities a public health emergency, pledging federal resources to help combat the growing problem. It is a huge problem. What else is going on these days? Let's check in with the skies with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what's going on?
Nothing can compare to what humanity does on this planet.
Oh, my gosh.
A bit of a radical departure from my traditional report. Following in the footsteps of your excellent coverage of the disappearance of Malaysian flight MH370, I'd like to use my time here tonight to address another mysterious and tragic aircraft accident that took place 15 years ago this week,
okay,
Wednesday, October 23rd, 2002, near Mobile, Alabama, in which the pilot tragically perished, and the cause of which, to this day, George, remains a baffling mystery. I feel duty-bound to preface my report by stating up front that I have absolutely no evidence, at least yet, that leads me to believe that the accident was in any way due to the presence of a UFO, but the facts surrounding the mid-air collision and subsequent crash of the aircraft are so bizarre as to defy belief, a fact that the National Transportation Safety Board seems to agree with. In fact, the pilot's family brought legal pressure to bear more than a year after the accident in an attempt to force the NTSB to reach a final conclusion as to what had caused the crash, something that had been unable to do up to that point. The facts surrounding the accident briefly are the following. The aircraft, a Cessna 208B Cargomaster, a large single-engine high-wing turboprop, departed the Mobile, Alabama Municipal Airport with cargo at approximately 7:40 p.m. that night. As it was climbing out to the northeast, air traffic control advised the pilot that there was another aircraft, a DC-10, about 7 miles ahead and 1,000 feet above his aircraft. The Cessna pilot acknowledged this routine advisory, but strangely, 16 seconds later, George, he came back on the air and blurted out, "I needed to deviate, I needed to deviate, I needed to," at which point his transmission suddenly ceased. The mangled fuselage was found fairly quickly in a shallow body of water, but strangely, the engine had either been ripped from or more likely cleanly severed from the rest of the aircraft, as if a guillotine blade had cut the engine from the rest of the fuselage. Moreover, and I'm just glossing over some of the facts here, the fuselage of the aircraft and the interior of the cabin exhibited strange marks, red marks, that the NTSB was never able to identify. They couldn't even identify the substance that had caused them. Anyone interested in more information about the incident can find a number of good articles on the Internet by searching for Night Flight 282. It's a fascinating case.
Super. All right, Peter, what else is up for you? Any speaking engagements?
Well, indeed we do. Two nights from now, George, in Harrington, Washington, at our lovely Harrington Opera House, we're hosting Maureen Morgan, the newly installed state director for MUFON,
great,
state of Washington. She's going to give a talk on her collection of photographs of cave paintings suggestive of UFO activity going back, I think, 12,000 years, and then she and I will do a Q&A after she's speaking. It's going to be a lot of fun. I hope people come and enjoy it with us.
Super. Up next, we're going to talk about the nature of time in the universe. It's called the Quantum Labyrinth. Paul Halpern joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Now, you know, listening to this program, we love science and physics and cosmology, and we're going to be talking with Paul Halpern in just a moment. He's the author of The Quantum Labyrinth. He is an acclaimed science writer, physicist as well, author of many scientific books that explore the subjects of space-time, higher dimensions, dark energy, dark matter, exoplanets, particle physics, and cosmology, recipient of a number of awards, including the Guggenheim Fellowship, which is a Fulbright scholarship as well. And Paul, welcome to the program. Looking forward to this.
Hi, George. It's a pleasure being on your show.
Great book, by the way. I wasn't really aware of Richard Feynman and John Wheeler. Everybody knows Einstein. Not a lot of people know these two. They were very important.
Yeah, well, a revolution that took place in the 1940s and is continuing today is just as important as the revolution in the 20s with Einstein and Schrodinger and so forth, but it's just not as well known. Feynman was, in his time, one of the best known American physicists because of his television programs. He was also involved in the Challenger disaster. Not in the disaster, but in terms of the commission.
Yeah, that investigated
disaster.
It. Yeah.
and Wheeler did a lot of public commissions, and he was involved in various bomb projects. But somehow Einstein is still the most famous physicist out there.
Well, it's an amazing work, and I'm going to have you explain in a moment the title so you can kind of weave us through this. But I'm going to ask you some other questions about cosmology and physics and what's going on here, because just all of it for me, since I've been a little boy, Paul, has been fascinating. How it happened, the origin, you know, we bring the God factor in a lot. One of the reasons I think we do, because we really can't explain the origin of anything.
And yeah, well, there are a lot of mysteries out there, and I think science can go so far in terms of pushing back and looking at the early universe and looking at the first instance of time. But, you know, I have to confess that there are moments in which science can explain, like what happened before the beginning of time, what happened before the Big Bang.
I know exactly. What was here before that, if anything? And I don't get how something started from nothing. I can't comprehend it.
Yeah, well, it's a mystery, and I think we can only speculate, and various scientists have different schemes. You can only also speculate about what's beyond the observable universe. There's only so far that our telescopes can see, and beyond that is the unknown.
Are you now a proponent that we are in a system of multiverses, not just this universe?
Well, I'm open-minded about it. I think it's a theoretical construct. There's no experimental proof that we're in a multiverse. People are looking for evidence in terms of scars in the early universe that might point to collisions with other universes in the past. That's something that's been looked at seriously. But so far, no one has found any conclusive evidence that there is anything beyond the observable universe that we see today.
So here's a question for you. If you're on the inside of a balloon and it continues to expand, it's expanding into something. But if you're in the balloon, you eventually come to the end of it as it expands. With the universe, theoretically, if we got to the end of it, is there an end to it? What's there?
Well, the thing is, it's not like space is expanding into something else. Space is just getting bigger and bigger. So even if space continues to expand, it's not like we'll reach a barrier. It's like if you have a sheet and you put dots on it evenly spread and you stretch out the sheet, the dots will be twice as far or three times as far. But if the sheet is infinite and you stretch it, it will still be infinite. There's not going to be a limit.
But you can't say what it's stretching into?
No, because it's space itself is all that's out there. So if space is expanding, it just means that things are getting farther apart. It's not that it's expanding into something.
All right, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break here, Paul, and then we're going to come back and talk about the quantum labyrinth. We'll get into the title of it. We're talking space and time tonight for a couple hours. And next hour, of course, we'll take your phone calls with Paul. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. This just fascinates me. I mean, think about the Big Bang Theory, where something was supposed to have started from nothing. But what was it before that? That's what's fascinating to me. Anyways, that'll be just one of my many questions. We'll take yours later on tonight, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We shall be right back. Well, a couple little notes for you. Our last luncheon for the year, Tuesday, November 14th, here in Los Angeles with hypnotherapist Dr. Bruce Goldberg. So come on out and have some fun. Send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. Include your name, obviously, and your phone number. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. That's Luncheon with Dr. Bruce Goldberg. I'll be there too, November 14th. And also, as we wind down our October trivia contest, and lots of folks are happy with it, for entry info and rules, visit coasttocoastam.com. But I'm going to give you the question and the potential answers, and all you need to do is go to our website and try to get this right. If you're right, your name goes into the hat for a weekly drawing, and you're eligible every day to participate. So, you know, in theory, if you had started on Monday and got them all right during the week, you'd have five entries. So tonight's question is, in a recent report on a mysterious treasure hunt in India, what did the organizers insist that the diggers of a tunnel carry in their pocket? A, lemons. B, porcupine bones. C, salt packets. Or D, rabbit's foot. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com and get that answer and participate. And welcome back. Paul Halpern with us. The name of his book, The Quantum Labyrinth. And explain that title, Paul. What does that mean?
Well, what I look at is a revolution in time that started in the 1940s and is continuing today. And it takes time from something that is linear to something which is labyrinthine, something that has many forks, branches out. And that's what modern quantum physics thinks of time, how we look at time, because it's not the case that if two things interact in quantum physics, that they just interact one way. But rather, and this is Richard Feynman and John Wheeler's revolution, they showed that any kind of interaction takes place a number of different ways, but all at once. It's as if somebody is walking from one place to another, but not just along one path, but along multiple paths at the same time. And you need to add up all these possibilities, all these alternatives, and sum them up, and that's what gives you reality. So that started the ball rolling in terms of looking at reality in terms of parallel universes. Richard Feynman was not very philosophical, so he didn't think of these as actual parallel universes, but rather as internal alternatives, internal possibilities that needed to be blended together to create the actual reality. But then later, another student of John Wheeler took that idea and started pushing towards something called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which looks at an actual splitting of time. Every time you take a quantum measurement, reality splits, and you have multiple versions of yourself experiencing different alternatives of that quantum measurement.
Now, did Wheeler and Feynman get together with any specific theories about any of this?
Well, when they started out in 1939, they were trying to tackle the question of what is the smallest unit, what is the most fundamental unit in reality. And Wheeler had this idea that the electron, which was one of the few particles known at the time, was the component or basis of everything in the universe. And he wanted to show that electrons, by interacting with each other, by kind of talking to each other directly, they could create all the forces in the universe and show how the universe is built. And at one point, he told Feynman, when Feynman was a graduate student, that there is only a single electron in the universe that travels backward and forward in time, and that all of reality is composed of a single electron. And Feynman was dubious about that, but the basis of the idea that electrons can travel back in time and become positrons became the essence of his later Nobel Prize, where he did he came up with something called Feynman diagrams, which shows how particles interact. And those are still used today. We still think of positrons, which are positive versions of electrons, as being something like electrons moving backward in time. But no one really believes that the electrons are actually moving backward in time. It just creates that's something that works for the calculation.
How close were they to developing time travel?
Well, Wheeler took something that Einstein developed, which was called the Einstein-Rosen bridge, and developed it into something called a wormhole. Now, a wormhole is a connection between different parts of space. And Wheeler was hoping to use these wormholes to model particles. This is a later period when he'd given up the idea that everything was electrons and switched to the idea that everything is geometry. And Wheeler came up with the idea of wormholes, and then later his student, who just won the Nobel Prize, Kip Thorne, said in the 80s...
Kip Thorne was his student?
Yes.
That's
yes,
amazing.
That's right. Yeah. So that's another thing that Wheeler's famous for. He had very good students. He had Nobel Prize-winning students. Feynman won the Nobel Prize. Kip Thorne won the Nobel Prize. And Kip Thorne, in the 1980s, was asked by Carl Sagan, how can you travel through space in a reasonable way? Because Carl Sagan was writing a science fiction novel, Contact. And Carl Sagan contacted Kip Thorne and said, well, can you use black holes to travel from one point in space to another? And Kip Thorne said, well, if you try to go into a black hole, you would be crushed. So that wouldn't be a realistic way of traveling through space. But there's something called wormholes. And Kip Thorne remembered John Wheeler's wormholes and said, well, what if you could take a wormhole and make it very big enough to travel through, and you could boost it open, prop it open so that you wouldn't be crushed when you went through it. And that became the basis of what are called traversable wormholes. And these are completely hypothetical, but if they could be constructed, they could connect different parts of space and be accessible to space travel. Now, that said, you would need more matter than is in the galaxy to create these, so we're not anywhere near coming up with something like this.
When you look at all of this, Paul, do you conclude that this is not done by this is not an accident, it's not random, that there's some kind of design to this?
Can you conclude
that?
I don't conclude that. I try to keep science and faith or belief separate. I think there's value to both. I think with science, one can speculate, but one has to base science on experimental evidence. So I don't see experimental evidence for design. I understand why some people believe in that, but it's not something that I think shines from the evidence. Everything we see about the universe can be explained scientifically without imagining a designer.
Now, who was Hugh Everett?
So Hugh Everett was the creator of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. He was a young student of Wheeler, and he came up with a question about quantum physics. He said, if quantum physics requires a human observer, and a human observer is made up of atoms, and atoms obey quantum laws, then how can you separate the observer from what's being observed? He saw that as an absurdity. So he decided to come up with a way that things that are observed and the observers are part of the same system. And the way he saw to do that is to say that every time you make an observation, reality splits. And every copy of the observer would see a different result. And every copy would think that he or she is the only observer, the only real one, and not know about all the other ones. He compared this to something like an amoeba splitting. So imagine an intelligent amoeba splitting, and you know, as do amoebas, and the children of the parent amoebas would all think that they're the original one, and none of them would realize that that there are many copies. They would just think that they're the only copy. And Hugh Everett proposed this to Wheeler, and he thought it was an interesting idea, but he kind of toned it down. He said, okay, we want to market this. And he wanted to market it specifically to Niels Bohr, who was one of the founders of quantum physics.
Another giant.
Right, right. And he said, you know, let's try to, you know, tone down the language a little bit. Let's not say that we're splitting. Let's not say parallel universes. Let's not say forking reality. Let's just say that this is a mathematical process by which you can have a single wave function. Wave function is the basis of quantum physics. It's the entity that drives quantum physics. And he said, let's just have that as the basis of this, and therefore maybe Bohr will buy this. And Bohr was still very dubious. Bohr was conservative in his ideas and wanted to kind of stick to the original interpretation of quantum physics, which has to do with a measurer taking a measurement, and depending on what the measurer decides to do, that's the result, rather than the measurer him or herself splitting.
Everett sadly died at the age of 51 of a massive heart attack. No telling how much more physics and information we would have gotten had he lived longer.
Yeah, well, he actually, his career became diverted because after he couldn't convince Bohr of his ideas, he switched to military research and took a long break from doing this fundamental physics research. And then later, physicists began to realize the importance of his work, and they called him into a conference, and they produced a book of his works. And that wasn't really until the 1960s and 1970s, even though he did his main work in the 1950s. And he was flattered that people were looking at his ideas again and started to reconsider them. And then he had the heart attack, of course.
Paul, I've always wondered what these kinds of physicists would be like, including Einstein, if they had computers then, personal computers. Do you think that they would have changed their theories, made them better, if they had the use of a computer?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. Feynman was involved with some of the early computers, and then when the personal computers came out, this was the last decade of Feynman's life, and Wheeler lived very long, so Wheeler experienced computers for a few decades. They became fascinated with computers, actually, and Wheeler switched a third time in terms of the fundamental components of the universe. His first idea was that everything was electrons and particles. His second idea was that everything was geometry, that you have these shapes like wormholes that make up everything. And then in the 1970s and 1980s, Wheeler said, "It from bit." "It from bit" was his slogan, his motto, meaning that everything comes from bits, computer bits. And he began to believe that everything was made of information, ones and zeros. And Feynman was considering that idea too, but Feynman showed that if you tried to program the universe like a computer program, and you just use a standard computer program, you can't really explain quantum physics because you don't have the same blurriness that you would in quantum physics. So that's when Feynman coined the idea of a quantum computer, and instead of a bit, a one or a zero, you have something that's a mixture called a qubit. And today, various firms are trying to put out actual quantum computers. So this was something that Feynman had thought of, had dreamed about. Wheeler had talked about it from bit, and now something like that is being realized today.
Were these guys pioneers?
Yes, they were certainly pioneers of ideas. That Feynman's work is used all the time in particle physics. His diagrams are ubiquitous. Everybody uses Feynman diagrams, which look like little squiggles and lines, but they're very, very powerful mathematically. And Wheeler coined the idea of black holes. He didn't actually come up with the term, but he heard that being used, and he popularized the term black hole. And of course, nowadays in astronomy, black holes are one of the most interesting features in astronomy, and people talk about them all the time. So Wheeler is really the father of modern black hole theory.
Are we losing this kind of brain power, Paul, in this country? Are we getting people to replace the Wheelers and the Einsteins and the Feynmans?
Well, I think this kind of work requires a lot of concentration and a lot of focus. And I would worry, I have a lot of respect for young people, but if they don't kind of take the time to focus on problems in a very, very serious way and avoid distractions, then it's very hard to make breakthroughs. So I think today the big issue is a lot of people are faced with distractions and don't take the time to say, okay, I'm going to spend weeks, hours, days, weeks, just thinking about one problem and coming up with the conclusion. And that's what Wheeler and Feynman both did. They would think about things for an incredibly long period of time and really focus on these things and then come up with an answer, rather than kind of thinking about things sporadically.
As a physicist, if you could get one question answered, what would that question be?
Well, I'm really interested in whether or not there are higher dimensions. I think that's a key question today that's trying to be resolved at CERN, and in terms of what it's called string theory, M theory. So far, there's no evidence that there are dimensions beyond the three spatial dimensions and one dimension of time.
Really, even though they talk about many more, right?
Yeah, there's so many mathematical theories out there, but there's no experimental evidence yet. So that's kind of an interesting question. If they don't find experimental evidence, as a scientist, I think we can't really continue to talk about these things except, you know, hypothetically, unless they find some proof that there are extra avenues, extra dimensions that we can't directly see.
You wrote a book also on Schrodinger's cat.
Mm-hmm.
What's that theory?
So Schrodinger was skeptical, even though he was one of the founders of quantum mechanics. He was very skeptical about a couple of ideas in quantum mechanics. And one is called entanglement, which means that two things are connected, so that if you try to tamper with one or affect one, the other one is affected. And the other thing he was skeptical about was the idea that that quantum mechanics can apply to apply to everything. It really should only be applied to small particles. And so there are a number of things he was kind of dubious about. So he came up with this hypothetical thought experiment in which you put a cat in a box and you close off the box, and then you put inside the box a vial of poison and a uranium sample, or a sample of a radioactive substance, and a Geiger counter. And you rig it so that within 1 hour, there's a 50-50 chance that the radioactive substance will decay. And according to quantum mechanics, this is in a superposition of states, meaning a mixture or medley of the two possibilities, decayed or undecayed. Well, so Schrodinger thought that was a little bit silly, that you could have a mixture of two things at once. And to emphasize this point, he said, well, suppose the Geiger counter was rigged so that if the particle decayed, then it would break open the vial, release the poison, and kill the cat. But if the decay didn't happen, then the cat would be spared. But because it's in a closed box and you haven't measured it yet, according to quantum theory, the substance should be in a mixed state of decayed or undecayed until it's observed, until you open a box.
So you don't know.
Similarly, the cat would be in a mixed state of alive and dead until you open the box.
Huh.
Now, Schrodinger didn't really believe that, but he said that that's a logical conclusion. So he thought that was a logical absurdity, and he thought he would convince people that that part of quantum mechanics was wrong. Well, he didn't really convince anyone, and the cat persists as a kind of a physics legend. But the experiment is never really done for real. It's just a thought experiment.
Paul, when we come back, let's talk about wormholes and time travel, whether you think time travel will indeed be possible. Plus, in the final hour here, we'll open up the phone lines to give you a chance to talk to a real physicist, the Quantum Labyrinth. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Time travel has always fascinated me. As a matter of fact, I was looking up the story of John Titor. Remember him? The so-called time traveler from 2036. We'll be back.